Now to a tale set in Minnesota. The Sorrows of an American by Siri Husvedt. The novel begins when a brother and sister, Eric and Inga Davidson, uncover a mysterious letter amid their late father's papers. The letter is dated June 27th, 1937.
Dear Lars, I know you will never ever say nothing about what happened. We swore it on the Bible. It can't matter now she's in heaven or to the ones here on earth. I believe in your promise. Lisa.
From there, the novel becomes a quest for the past. Now, we don't want to give away just what the family secret is. For that, you'll have to read the book. But the story, according to Siri Husvedt, is about much more.
Even more than the letter, Eric begins a search for the depths of his father. And I think in some way he begins to find his father in himself. So there's a theme of being occupied or inhabited by other people even when they're dead.
Mm-hmm. It was fascinating the way you used your own father's unpublished memoir in this book. He was a descendant of Norwegian immigrants, and life was very hard. And tell us more about him.
Well, he grew up on a farm during the Depression, and the farm was actually ruined by the Depression. They couldn't make a go of it. They lost part of their land, and this story became, I think, a real grief for my own father. He carried it with him his whole life, and he was certainly the model for Lars Davidson in the book.
Let's have you, if you would please, read a little bit from his memoir, which you use so seamlessly in your own text. It really takes us back to a grim time. This is not Garrison Keillor's mirthful Norwegian context. This is something
Bachelor
else.
Farmers, no, mm-hmm. This is something a little different. Looking back at our early life, the most astonishing feature must be how small our house was. A kitchen, living room, and bedroom on the first floor came to 476 square feet. Two lofts on the second floor, which were used as bedrooms, provided the same amount of floor space. There was no furnace. A wood-burning range warmed the kitchen, and a heater cared for the living room. Except for storm windows, the house had no insulation. The water in the tea kettle was often frozen by morning. One winter in the early 1930s, we ran out of wood. If one must burn green wood, ash and maple will serve you best.
You know, as I was reading that, I kept thinking that it was something out of the 19th century, not the 20th century.
It's true. And actually, I think a form of 19th century prairie life went on much longer in that particular part of Minnesota than many other places. My father also grew up speaking Norwegian, and he spoke English with a Norwegian accent until the day he died, which is amazing considering he was a third-generation Norwegian-American.
Eric, your protagonist, is looking for old family secrets, but something more as well. He suspects that his father may have been, is the word pronounced, a fugger?
Fugger is an old word, but it is something that does still exist in the psychiatric literature. It's now called dissociated fugue states. This was something that got a lot of play in the 19th century in medicine, and it was men, always men, who would suddenly vanish from their homes, run off, and forget who they were. This is not actually the case with the father. But he does go out on fugues. He walks, and that is a kind of escape. And by the end of the book, Eric begins to understand, I think, a bit more why he walked.
One of your reviewers, you know, thinking about everything that you have knit together here, there are a number of subplots, but the action does go back and forth between Minnesota and New York, between the past and the present. One of your reviewers said, America is a large and strange country. And I thought that you really captured that strangeness here.
It is a large and strange country. And I think I wanted to bring into this book that richness that also exists in American life. And since I grew up in a small town in Minnesota, very much like my two sister and brother characters in the novel, that small town world hasn't completely vanished. And people are doing very strange and interesting and complex things all over the place. And there are these two women in the book who make dolls. And those dolls are very peculiar because they all have something wrong with them. They're all wounded or damaged in some way.
And Eric and Inga, his sister, asked the doll maker if what comes first, the story or the doll?
And she says that the story always comes first. So the implication is that these two women are making images of actual people who have lived these stories. One is a little girl. She's on crutches and has a cast. And there's another doll that is sitting in a chair in overalls. It's a man, and he's holding a letter in his hand. And the letter is a letter about his son's death in the Second World War.
American Gothic.
A bit, yes.
And our mystery is revealed. One of the many mysteries in here is revealed in these dolls. We won't say what that is. But I'd like you to just leave us, if you would, with some of that humor from the Scandinavian plains. And on the 80th birthday of Eric's father, Lars Davidson, he makes a speech. The speech he makes, I think, is a real testament to the perseverance of that previous generation of settlers.
Yes, it's true. And I have to say that I stole this directly from my own father at his 80th birthday. So this is how he began his speech. "I read a small ad in the newspaper not so long ago," he said, "that went like this. Lost cat, brown and white, thinning fur, torn left ear, blind in one eye, missing tail, limps on front right foreleg. Answers to the name of Lucky."
Siri Husvedt. Her latest novel is called The Sorrows of an American. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Pat Foy is at the Philadelphia Flower Show when she finds out that her husband has been arrested. Pat's husband is an almost endearingly dull, suburban New Jersey accountant suspected of cooking the books at his telecommunications company for a group called the High Risk Boys. It's a Crime is the title of Jacqueline Carey's new comic novel, a story of how Pat, a landscape designer, sets out to randomly repay some of the victims of corporate crimes. Jacqueline Carey joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
That's great to be here.
I guess it's not necessary to ask what put the sequence of events in your mind. We can just kind of thumb through the newspapers and guess between WorldCom, Enron.
Yeah, right. The WorldCom and the Enron debacles were really big.
Pat's husband, Frank Foy, offers at one point in a family conversation a kind of defense of his actions by saying, quote, "We may not have made the best business decisions at Linkage," his company, "but we didn't do anything that unusual."
When I was doing research for this...
Well, that's why I wanted to open the door on this. That's
when
what
I was
kind
doing
of
research for
yeah.
this, I picked out, like, the really cool little tidbits of crimes from a lot of different companies. Like, for instance, Frank sends out people he calls the SWAT team, you know, and all they're doing is they're looking for holes in the different smaller companies and thinking of barely legal ways to fix them. That was Enron. Post-dated invoices was Lucent. When there's no reason not to make everything tidy, they're not going to make things tidy. They're going to take chances. And it's not terrible that people take chances. You just have to cut them off at the pass sometimes, I guess. But, you know, I have this other character, Lemuel Samuel, who is a mystery writer and who is another...
Former boyfriend.
Former boyfriend, who is another person who takes a lot of risks, mainly with his own health, but... You know, he's one of these hard-drinking, beat-em-up type of detectives. And I wanted to look at the way crime is in the United States. I mean, it's on the one hand, we've got WorldCom, and on the other hand, we've got, you know, the sort of risk-taking behavior that makes America, America. You know, they're really entwined.
They're really entwined.
Yeah, they are.
Can't have one without the other entwined.
Yeah, or... I mean, Pat is a good person, and she is... blind to the fact that she is taking advantage of this completely fraudulent setup. And I think that people who live in nice houses forget sometimes all the help they've had to get there, for instance, just in the most basic, you know, kind of level. Pat is benefiting from this actual crime. On the other hand, Do you really want to have the reader just identify with the victim? You know, I was trying to do it from both sides, both the criminal's point of view and the victim's point of view. And of course, you know, Pat is also a victim.
How much time do you spend in research and how much in writing?
Well, see, this was so much fun. I spent more time than I, you know, I really had to. My daughter was a big mock trial star in high school, so we went to a lot of trials together. I would come in maybe every couple of weeks.
Now, where were you seeing these trials?
Both Tyco and WorldCom in New York. I saw the WorldCom people being sentenced, and then I'd followed them down, and I, you know, and walked out with them.
You have a couple of descriptions in there where you're talking about the photographers going
all
crazy.
All based on stuff I saw.
It's hard for people who haven't seen it to quite understand the fury of a scene
and,
like that.
And really, there was one that was, he couldn't find a cab. And it was really worse when the photographers finally gave up and left him alone because he was just, he didn't know what he was doing. And finally, I just went up and told him where to get a cab. It's the only time I ever spoke to anybody that I just thought, you know, I got to do something. This is ridiculous.
Let me ask you to read a section of this book. Pat Foy is visiting her husband, Frank, in prison. She's brought along their daughter, Ruby.
Sure. Happy Thanksgiving, she said, perched on the molded plastic chair. She told Frank he was looking good, a little white lie. Because he had been defined by his decisive and sometimes overbearing energy, it was difficult to see him so restrained, so skinny, so watchful. So how's Winky? He asked. Ruby had been given Winky as a puppy years before. Good, she said briefly. Pat decided not to mention that Ruby's social studies teacher had called yesterday to find out why she was missing so much school. It's not bad here, said Frank. Then he attempted more jauntiness, maybe even irony. Yesterday we had apples. How nice, cried Pat. I love apples. You know that the forbidden fruit was a fig, not an apple. Sometimes I wish you were in here with me, said Frank. That's so sweet, said Pat. I don't know why you shouldn't be, said Frank, still smiling. You're the one who's still reaping the benefits of my evil behavior.
When it's all over, you realize one of the questions, at least I did, that you seem to raise in your novel is, what is that elemental fascination that Pat had for Frank?
Well, he always has a kind of appetite, clearly. And
he likes living well, fine
right,
restaurants. He even says, right. While he's in prison at one point, I'll call a, or I wish I could call ahead to make a reservation for you there.
Yes.
I know I could, yeah.
You know, it's a more socially sanctioned appetite than, you know, her old boyfriend Lemuel Samuel has. But it is still very real. And he chafes at ordinariness in a similar sort of way to Lemuel Samuel. Now, I think he was led over the line. I don't think he would have gone over the line by himself. But, you know, so many of those people were.
But still, what was the fascination that... Why are Frank and Pat together? Can you tell us?
She's not at all turned off by his ambition, by his, you know, grandiose, very soon, very grandiose plans. No, she thinks it's exciting, too.
Mm-hmm. Jacqueline Carey, her new novel is It's a Crime.
Sarah Palin's childhood home faces Alaska's Talkeetna Mountains. In the spring, purple violets, Indian paintbrush, and wild geraniums carpet the mountain's alpine tundra in a bloom of color. In winter, the snow-covered mountains take on a rose blush in the soft alpenglow. Sarah could see these mountains from the front porch of the family's little house near downtown Wasilla. These mountains would become like other wild places in Alaska, a place of sustenance and renewal for her boisterous and busy family. That's an excerpt from Sarah, How a Hockey Mom Turned Alaska's Political Establishment Upside Down, a biography of Sarah Palin published this spring. The author, Kayleen Johnson, joins me now. She's a longtime Alaskan herself and lives in Wasilla, Alaska. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Leanne. Thank you.
Was Sarah Palin born in Alaska?
She was born in Sandpoint, Idaho, but she moved to Alaska with her family when she was just 2 months old. So she is a lifelong Alaskan.
Tell us about her life growing up in Wasilla. And it's a town that you write back in 1974 had only 400 residents?
That's right. She grew up in Wasilla. It started out as a small community of 400, but by the time she became the mayor, it was closer to 4,000. and it's doubled that since then. So this is very much a growing community.
And what kind of town was it? I mean, how did Sarah, you know, occupy her time?
Her father was a school teacher, and in the summertime, he would take the television, unplug it, and put it away. And instead, he put out a basketball hoop out in the yard, and the kids were to be out active and be out playing and using their imagination. So they did a lot of hiking. They did a lot of berry picking. They did a lot of basketball. And so that's how they spent their time, was outdoors.
But you write that Sarah was an avid reader.
That's right. She would read the paper from cover to cover from a very young age, which her sisters both thought was rather odd. But she's always been interested in current events, and I think that's probably what led her to her degree in journalism, and that with a minor in political science.
Sarah Palin is an evangelical Christian, and in one passage you write, Sarah took the commitment she made to God as a youngster seriously, even through high school. She signed yearbooks with Bible verses, held fast to the New Testament admonition from 1 Thessalonians 5:17, which says, "Be joyful always, pray continually, give thanks in all circumstances." Can you tell us more about her faith and how this informed her?
Well, I think it really shapes who she is. Her mother grew up Catholic, and she grew up Catholic for part of that time, and then her mother, Sally, really found a more meaningful path through the Wesleyan Assembly of God Church and started taking her family there. And I think over the course of time and through Bible school and their involvement in church there, I think that Sarah eventually embraced those ideals and beliefs as her own.
She was called Sarah Barracuda on the basketball. Why was she called that?
Well, she's fiercely competitive, and she's also a very hard worker. Her father was actually a coach for track and cross country, the teams she was on. And what he said was what she lacked in raw talent, she more than made up for in hard work. And I think that work ethic was something that she took with her wherever she, in whatever endeavors she undertook.
Her involvement in politics, she began on the Wasilla City Council. She later became mayor. Tell us a little bit about that involvement, why she did it, and how she made it happen.
Well, she was invited by a fellow council member to run for the council, and I think this person that invited her assumed that she would be a team player and get on board and just sort of go along with the flow. And she would tell you that they didn't realize that she wasn't quite wired that way. She did run for the city council. She won. And she really saw that, you know, it was a bit of a club and a bit of a boys' network, and she really didn't like how business was being done on the city council. So she fought City Hall, if you will, and it made some impressions and it made some people mad. And in the end, she decided that, you know, if there was really going to be change in the government of this community, it had to come from the top. So she ran for mayor and won.
You paint a picture of Governor Sarah Palin and vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin as being a very strong woman. You've talked a lot about her strengths. What would you say her weaknesses are?
You know, I'm really at a loss. You know, I went into writing the book a bit of a skeptic, I have to say. You know, I've just been jaded with politics in Alaska in particular, And I went into it a bit of a skeptic, but I came out feeling pretty pretty hopeful, you know, that this is one of those people that, you know, really is different.
In your introduction, you write, "The biggest mistake her adversaries make is underestimating her."
I think that's absolutely the case. She comes across as an average American, and she is, and as an average mom, and she is, but she's also extraordinary. She's very strong-willed. She stands, I think, on principle more than she stands on party, and that has gotten her into a lot of hot water in the Republican Party in Alaska in the past. So I think that in some ways she's very ordinary, in other ways she's very extraordinary.
Kayleen Johnson is the author of Sarah, How a Hockey Mom Turned Alaska's Political Establishment Upside Down, a biography of Sarah Palin, the Republican vice presidential nominee. Kayleen Johnson joined us from Wasilla, Alaska. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leanne.
Untold thousands, maybe millions of students will read J.D. Salinger's 1951 novel, The Catcher in the Rye, this year. It will be read and treasured by many, barely read, and mostly forgotten by many others. But one thing's for sure, it'll be assigned. High school teachers have been assigning the story of Holden Caulfield, his anger, angst, expulsion from prep school, and struggles to make sense of his life in New York since John F. Kennedy was in the White House. They know the book. They have supporting materials to pass out. They know how to teach it. But Anne Trubeck, a professor of English at Oberlin College, argues in the current issue of Good magazine that the book ought to be replaced in curriculum. Professor Trubeck joins us from member station WCPN in Cleveland. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's your problem with The Catcher in the Rye?
I don't have a problem with The Catcher in the Rye, but it's often assigned as the end of the year, as it were, contemporary novel that's supposed to resonate with high school students. But as you mentioned, it was published in 1951, and it's not so contemporary anymore. And I think we should start looking at what novels might do a better job of reaching high school students and talking about their experiences.
Let me try to make the case for The Catcher in the Rye for you.
Okay.
Beginning with the fact that this book used to get banned a lot. Mm-hmm. I found that very alluring.
Absolutely. And it still is banned in some school districts. But I think that most American teenagers will find it rather tame and sort of laughable, the things that were once considered so controversial.
You say in this article in Good magazine that, as a matter of fact, The Catcher in the Rye supplanted David Copperfield when it was included in a lot of reading lists.
Well, Salinger begins by having Holden say that he's not going to rehearse all that David Copperfield crap. And he really sort of takes a pot shot at Dickens by sort of positioning his novel as a more contemporary coming-of-age tale and sort of saying, look, kids have been forced to read this text forever. That's sort of what Holden is saying, and I'm going to cut through all that and be something that's going to speak to you, contemporary readers of this novel. So Salinger actually positions himself as a replacement for Copperfield.
Aside from the fact that Holden Caulfield, you know, never used a cell phone or went to a Starbucks, what, in your judgment, makes his experience no longer pertinent?
Well, I think his experience of adolescent alienation is pertinent. But he's also an upper-class white man who's going to a prep school. And so he is from a very elite background. And many of the people who first wrote about how he was such a universal voice for American teenagers came from that same class and had the power and prestige to write about him. And people who have different backgrounds may not have felt the same at the time and may not feel the same today.
But it's a classic, isn't it? Books that have been published and might seem to be more pertinent that have been published in the last 5 or 6 years can't really be called classics yet, can they?
Well, actually, Catcher in the Rye was considered an instant classic. It was vaunted to the stature of classic only a few years after it was published. Classics are man-made. And no reason why we couldn't do the same with some of the things that have been written the last 10 years.
You suggest some books.
I think Jeffy Eugenides has a book called The Virgin Suicides. Juno Diaz, whose novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde, won the Pulitzer this year, has a book of short stories called Drown. My students all were telling me about this book called The Perks of Being a Wallflower. That was one that they all thought was a great novel about their experiences.
Professor, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Anne Trubeck, professor of rhetoric and composition and English at Oberlin College, speaking to us from member station WCPN, the Idea Stream in Cleveland. For more of Professor Trubeck's contemporary coming-of-age lit picks, you can go to our website, npr.org. In the laid-back beach town of Cape May, New Jersey, a serial killer is on the loose. The victims have one thing in common. They all love to sing karaoke. That's the premise of the title story in Murder-Oki, a collection by writer and karaoke host Terry O'Brien. It's a work of fiction, but as Joel Rose reports, it's also based on fact.
If you get on the Garden State Parkway heading south, you eventually wind up in Cape May. The further south you go, the more famous Terry O'Brien gets.
South of Exit 4 on the Garden State Parkway, Terry O'Brien is, you know, Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt. You hit Exit 6, it's like, well, who is this guy? I never heard of him.
With his stocky build and goatee, O'Brien looks more like Garth Brooks than Brad Pitt, but he's the undisputed karaoke king of Cape May. From May through the end of September, he hosts Terrioke 5 nights a week at local bars.
Sal gets to sing twice because he's amazingly, awesomely talented, and I owe him money.
On Monday nights, you can find him at Martini Beach on the second floor of an old Victorian house across the street from the Atlantic Ocean. O'Brien started hosting karaoke 4 years ago after working for over a decade as an actor. The business took off quickly. Tonight, all the tables at Martini Beach are packed with singers patiently waiting for their turn.
I'd say a solid 70, 75% of my singers are average to really good. There's a thriving community theater down here in Cape May. And a lot of those guys come out, they do their show, they have a drink, they come out, they sing some karaoke. And that just completely raises the bar. But even the average guy off the street is generally, I mean, they wouldn't do it if they didn't think they were any good at it.
Many of the regulars at karaoke have also appeared in O'Brien's column for the local weekly paper Exit Zero. Last year, O'Brien started writing a series of fictional short stories in which real-life karaoke singers mysteriously turn up dead.
He actually called me up one day and he says, "Would you mind if I kill you?" And I told him I might take it personal, and then he explained to me it was in a story he was writing.
Sal Riggi is a college professor and a regular at karaoke.
Yeah, I joked with him. I said, "Well, there might be some people up North Jersey that may not like that." I said, "But sure, go ahead." I said, "It's only a story."
How did he kill you?
Somebody bashed my head in with a microphone after I sung Run Around Sue.
Here's my story, it's sad but true. About a girl that I once knew. She took my love.
Riggi isn't the only karaoke regular who meets an untimely end in O'Brien's stories, which are now published in a book called Murderoki. Edward Cole, a hairdresser by trade, gets scalped after singing an Andrew Lloyd Webber tune. Cole says it's an honor to get killed in one of O'Brien's stories.
People were coming up to him, "Put me in your book, murder me, kill me," you know.
No one asks O'Brien to murder them tonight, at least not in so many words.
Sunrise, sunset, sunrise, sunset, swiftly blow the day.
Randy Rodelico and his wife Wendy have been coming to karaoke for several years.
I don't sing in karaoke. My husband likes to, and I kind of get embarrassed, but he does it anyway.
Yeah.
What I admire about Terry, and I didn't know anything about him when we started coming, is that he has three children, and of course he's married, and he's a hard worker.
There are so many singers at Martini Beach tonight that it's well after midnight before anyone gets a second turn.
It's unprecedented. I had 25 singers before I got to someone who did a second song, which is off the charts busy for me.
You know, before when you said that the quality of the singing is pretty good most of the time,
yeah,
I didn't believe you.
Few people do, because I think karaoke, drunk guys coming out to sing, you know, Summer Wind, but a lot of these guys really, they love to sing, and even if they're not great, they have the passion, and sometimes that passion makes up for perhaps a lack of natural, God-given talent.
Underline, sometimes. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
For more about these and other books, visit our website, npr.org/books.